Tonight we're going to be dealing with coping with capture and crisis in the field. I have a reason to be grateful to the Iron Lady Margaret Thatcher, because in October 1987, I and three other frontline fellowship missionaries were prisoners in Zambia, and it was the Prime Minister of England at that time, Margaret Thatcher, who intervened, personally spoke up for us and secured our release. We were driving through Botswana, across Kazungulu Ferry, to get to Zambia, and then across, we were going to go to Malawi. From Malawi, we were going to deploy into Mozambique, to reach northern Mozambique, Tete and Zambezi provinces. And so, our mission team of four of us, the first and only time in Frontline's history that every one of our team members carried a British passport. Four British passport holders. And it just so happened, on that time, it was the month that the Commonwealth Conference was going to meet in Vancouver, and Margaret Thatcher secured our release because we were her citizens, theoretically, officially. We ended up in here. What happened was, at Kazungulu Ferry, we did not pay a bribe. Kazungulu is the one place in the world where four countries meet, four sovereign countries, Zambia, Namibia, Zimbabwe, and Botswana. We were crossing the ferry there, and as we went to Zambia, we went that way to avoid Zimbabwe, because Zimbabwe doesn't like me for some strange reason. And as we went in Zambia, we're talking about October 1987, we were arrested, beaten, imprisoned, abused in Livingston. Of course, Zambia 1987 was very different from what Zambia is now. It was a one-party dictatorship. Kenneth Kaunda was a horrible dictator, and he had just been whipping the people up into hatred, hatred, hatred. And when we came along and we didn't pay a bribe, they just took us along to the police station in Livingston, beat us, stripped us, threw us into a stinking disease factory, hideous conditions, absolutely ghastly. And at the end of the first night, I counted 65 mosquito bites on 1 foot. Mm. 1 foot. Didn't bother to count the rest. I mean, our skins are just angry relief maps of all kinds of biting, crawling, horrible insects. And the next morning, I was hauled into an office. The day before, from early in the morning to late, had just been one big saga after another. In fact, to give you an idea of how it works when it comes to imprisonments and captures, there's often the good cop, bad cop routine, and there's the lifting up your expectations to smash them down again. And that's something they do standard. So, for example, there was lots of threats and threats, and then it'd be someone else who'd be reasonable. Well, we were taken from Kazungulu Ferry, after being there for hours, to Livingston, and there 50 soldiers stripped and searched our vehicle and laid everything out, and they noticed immediately a vast amount of gospel literature in Mozambican languages. Vast amount of camping equipment, things like this. So, from the interrogations late that afternoon, they were asking, why do you have Mozambican literature? Well, we're going to be ministering in Malawi, in this, in the refugee camps in Malawi. Many Mozambicans have fled to Malawi. But why do you have camping equipment? Well, we're going to camp. But in Malawi, you wouldn't need camping equipment. No, well, we camp. We don't want to pay for staying in hotels or anything like that. And they said, but you've got maps of Mozambique and you've got compasses. You're going to go into Mozambique illegally. And, of course, that's nothing to do with the law of Zambia, but this is the way they were considering. And, of course, we were sticking to our story that we're going to minister in a refugee camp in Malawi, which we would also do. But, of course, we were going to go into RENAMO-controlled, resistance-controlled Mozambique and be ministering in the area controlled by the anti-communist guerrillas. I mean, that's true. We were. But, of course, we could not openly speak about that at that stage. When I was pulled in the morning, the next morning, we'd already been in their prison through the night, they had on the table all of the literature I'd written at that stage. And I wasn't carrying it. We didn't carry our literature across the border. And they want to know, what do you think about Desmond Tutu? What do you think about Nelson Mandela? What do you think about Kenneth Kaunda? What do you think about communism? What do you think about liberation theology? What do you think about secular humanism, the official ideology of Zambia? And I said, am I here because of something I've done or because of what I believe? Shut up and answer the question, which seems contradictory. How do you do both? But that was the kind of thing going on. Well, I might say that as the evening approached, sun was setting, they said, one of the people came to us, here's the good cop. And he said, we see that you're innocent people and you've been wrongly detained, and you're free to go to a restaurant nearby if you've got money to pay for your own food, because we don't have food here, and we'll send an escort, and by the time we come back, we'll have done the paperwork so we can release you. So our people were happy and ecstatic. And we go then. Rob Brown, who's with me, he said, they're just preparing us to bring us down. And so, but the other two on the team, their expectations were sky high. Absolutely, this is great. They're both straight from Britain now. Rob, all I had a British passport, was Australian. He'd been Australian Special Forces, British Paratroopers, Rhodesian Special Air Service, South African Recce. He had seen the world. And he knew what was going on and what was to come. And I was inclined to believe him because I had read a lot about how things work. I read the Amnesty International reports, International Society of Human Rights. So I knew roughly what was coming from theory, but Rob knew from practice. The other two were, you know, all our problems are over and we're going to be sleeping in a hotel tonight. So we went and had this up. And of course, while we're chatting amongst ourselves, I'm well aware that the police are sitting at the next table and they're probably listening to every word we say. As you got back to the police station, grabbed, slammed into the wall, thrown to the floor, stripped of clothes, beaten, thrown into stinking cells. And it was just this, you know, the lift here, and they obviously intend to do this all along. And many times in imprisonments I've experienced, there will be these promises, and you think all our problems are over, and it's just preparation so that they can bring you down even harder the next time. And it's part of this thing to break you. Lift the expectations, shatter it. When I first went to army, my brother warned me. He said, your first pass will be cancelled. Know that. And so I remember when we were preparing for our first pass, we'd been in the army in training already for 9 weeks, and now they said, you know, your first pass. But my brother said, it's a sham. You won't get it. It's just to break you down. And so I knew this is not a real pass. So we come out for inspection the first morning. Ah, something is wrong, sir. Everyone into PT clothes and out. Everyone runs around. Too slow to the 2.4. Now it's got to be an 8.4. So everyone's running along there. Then they give, still too slow, poles, drums, tires. Now everyone's saying, you know, I've missed my first one. I missed the bus. And everyone's worked up and they just carry on. I say to them, guys, we're not going to get the pass. No, we are. Yeah, my girlfriend's waiting. Mm-hmm. And next thing, there's another inspection that came, kicking beds over, throwing buckets of sand and buckets of water over the beds. Oh. Another inspection in 1 hour, and everyone going berserk. I mean, how are you going to do that? And of course, by the end of the day, the sun's setting, pass cancelled. Guys going berserk, hitting their heads against the wall, screaming. I wasn't bothered because I already knew they were going to cancel. It wasn't a real pass. It was just being offered to be taken away. Now, when you know that when you're in an imprisoned situation, they are just going to lift up your expectations. We're about to release you so that they can break you down. And they're hoping when they break you down that you'll be open to say what they want. So the next morning, after a night in the stinking, disease-ridden, filthy cells, covered in filth, I mean degrading beyond comprehension, stinking cells, we dragged out and I see all my literature on the table. They're questioning and they're wanting to know what I think about everything from communism to Mandela and Tutu. And obviously didn't like the answers, because the next thing is hooded. Somebody came from behind and sack put overhead, stinking sack. Handcuffed, legs chained, dragged out a whole day, transported first on trucks, so going along on the truck, in the back of the truck, and going on a dirt road. And Rob's thinking, when I learned later from him, they're going to take us out into the bush, shoot us in the back of the head, and dig put us in a hole in the ground. Our other friends, the two guys from Britain, are thinking, oh, they're taking us home. We suddenly go onto a tarmac, and you can feel it's a tarmac. And Rob and I both recognize the surface changed. We're on, this isn't a road, this is a tarmac. This is flat concrete. And then we get into a plane, climb upstairs and get into a plane. And as the plane starts, the two English guys thinking, oh, great, they're flying us back home. Rob's thinking, they're going to take us up and throw us out of the plane. I'm thinking, oh, no, they might fly us to Mozambique or to Angola, both of which I've written lots of things at that stage, Killing Fields of Mozambique and Angola. I'm in deep trouble in Mozambique and Angola. In fact, in Mozambique, I had... Before that attack, before that arrest, I had in my hands a letter from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Department of Cults. Ministry of Justice, the Department of Religious Affairs. You come back to Mozambique, we will kill you. And that's on letterhead signed from the Ministry of Justice. I mean, that's how bad it was. So I'm thinking, worst case scenario, I'm being flown to Maputo. Then it crossed my mind, maybe I'm being flown to Harare. That wouldn't be even any better. Then I'm in Chikurubi, which is even worse. Or Luanda. So when we landed in Lusaka, I felt relief. Not that I knew immediately, but as we got to Lusaka Central Police Headquarters, they took off the hood, and that was when, after we hadn't drunk water in 25 hours, I was able to rasp out Romans 8:28. God works all things together for good for those who love Him and are called according to His purpose. And the next thing I noticed was our handcuffs said "Made in Great Britain," and that seemed very funny at the time. We were then taken through the streets of Lusaka singing gospel hymns. I remember singing "A Mighty Fortress Our God, This Is the Day That the Lord Has Made, stand up for Jesus, onward Christian soldiers." And we came in here to Lusaka Central Prison. And here's the entrance, here's interrogation wings, this is the main machine gun tower, observation tower, here's the cooking shed, here's death row. We went cell 11 over there. Cell 11 had all the presidential detainees. In our cell were people, none of whom had ever come to trial. We were just presidential detainees. There was a Malian businessman from Timbuktu. Businessman. Just thrown in jail. There was a truck driver from South Africa, Azai Moyo, who had lent money to ANC exiles, refugees, who decided not to pay their bills. An easy way not to pay your bill is accuse them of being spies. You didn't need evidence. So this poor man was in prison for having lent money to the ANC. And he was full of poker sores where they'd stuck red hot pokes in the fire and shoved into some pussy sores all over his body. His knees were callous from the amount of time he spent on his knees praying. There were many people there, including a colonel who had been trained in Sandhurst as an engineer, Zambian army. What was his crime? He had said sanctions will hurt Zambia more than South Africa. And for that unpatriotic, treasonous statement, he was in prison. Engineer trained in Sandhurst. And so there was a Hindu man who owned mines, and they'd confiscated his mines and thrown them into the prison, thrown away the key. There were 1,200 prisoners in this prison. The British built this prison for 80. And when the British built it, there was electricity and plumbing. When we were there, there was no electricity, no plumbing, nothing. I mean, no sanitation, no working, functioning toilets, no taps. Every bit of water to drink had to be carried in buckets. Every bit of filter to be carried out in buckets. There was no sanitation in this stinking disease factory. When the British ran Zambia, Northern Rhodesia, Kenneth Kaunda was in, I believe, that same cell we were in. But then it was neat, clean, painted, with only one person in the cell. He had his own bed and sheets and blankets, and he had couch and desk and bookcase, gramophone, 3 cooked meals a day. When we were there, no beds, no furniture, no sheets, no pillows. We were sleeping on the floor, 60 to 65 in the cell, 15 feet by 25 feet. That's smaller than this room. 60 to 65 in here. I mean, think right now, we feel a bit crammed. Now, you take out the carpet and all the furniture, and you put a whole lot of people, and low ceiling, corrugated iron ceiling. No windows. There was just a 1 foot hole square in the door with some bars. That was the only place for ventilation. People died in that heat and died in the night and were carried up in the morning. So Lusaka Central Prison was a very, very bad place. Ugly and hideous. It looks nice and clean from the outside. We were about there, cell 11. 1,200 prisoners in the prison. And every day, I walked backwards and forwards here to keep disciplined. People would be wanting to have counseling, and I would say, walk with me, and we'd walk backwards and forwards counseling. I would stand here each day and give preaching, and the people would gather in front of the shed here, and they could get some shade under the cooking shed. There was only one meal a day, and it was big, sort of huge poika cross type pot with just sadza, staver pup, porridge type thing. What do you call it?
Butcher
starch.
Pot?
Just starch.
Oh, okay, starch.
Yeah, we call it in Zimbabwe sadza.
Okay.
Yeah, sadza. But it's like a maize meal. Mm. And the only protein came from the flies that flew in, which was quite a few.
Yeah.
And that was it. And there was no plates, no eating utensils. You literally had to put out your hand and eat out of your hands. That was it. Oh, yeah. Oh, gee. Yes. But they didn't even give you a plate or a leaf to have it. It was degrading, disgusting conditions. Lusaka Central Prison. But we preached in there 16 days, ministering in this prison. Of course, barefoot, they took away our Bibles. The only Bible I had was what I could remember. So what you've stored in your memory, that's it. Now, the frontline mission team that I was leading was locked up in here. You can see we actually went through the small door. They never opened the big doors while I was there. And this is roughly how the people on later times I visited Lusaka Central to minister in the prison. And that's the way the people were put. Talk about foot and mouth disease. You have to be head to toe all over the place. There's not enough space. We spent excruciating weeks of abuse at the hands of Zambian security officials. I was hauled out 6 times for interrogation because they identified me as the head of the team, and they said, "We know what you whites hate." Said, "We can't torture you like we do our own citizens, because one day we'll have to let you go. You got a foreign passport, but we know what you don't like." And so they did waterboarding, which is head in buckets of water until you drown, heads in buckets of urine and filth, and of course no access to soap and water back at home. So I was, you know, being suffocated and passing out. You pass out and wake up later, lying in filth, choking on the ground. And there was this one time I asked the security branch, they called him special branch in Zambia. I saw he had a Mao Tse Tung little red book on his desk, and I asked him, "Can you get me my Bible? I wanted my Bible." And he hauled out his red book of Mao and he said, "You can have this. This is my Bible." So I looked at it and said, "Mao never died for your sins. Marx can't lead you to heaven. There's no salvation in communism." And I went straight back to the interrogation room. He didn't like that answer. But this was where we were. They worked out where they could punch us and not leave bruises just below the solar plexus. But I would not have cuts and bruises on my body when I was released, because they knew, you know, they couldn't do to me what they were doing to their people, which is red hot pokers, ripping up fingernails and so on. But they knew filth, degradation, waterboarding leaves no marks. Now, friends of ours ensured that the British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher was informed of our plight just before her departure for the Commonwealth Conference in Vancouver. Here you can see the providence of God, his timing. All the Commonwealth nations were gathering in Vancouver in October 1987, the very month that we were incarcerated in Lusaka Central Prison. And there Margaret Thatcher was subjected to haranguing by Zambian dictator Kenneth Kaunda, who was outraged that Britain was refusing to place economic sanctions on South Africa. If you can remember back to 1987, this was the big thing. Sanctions on South Africa. All the universities were having disinvestment campaigns, and Britain was refusing to put sanctions on South Africa. America had put sanctions in 1986, but Britain would not. And Margaret Thatcher responded by asking, "Why doesn't Zambia herself place sanctions on South Africa?" And Kaunda responded, "That would place many Zambians out of work." "Exactly," replied the British Prime Minister. "And as South Africa is one of our most important trading partners, many British citizens would be placed out of work if I was to impose sanctions on South Africa. Quite aside from many South Africans themselves who would be placed out of work." She then went on to relate how Zambians were dependent on South African maize grown in Orange Free State, how Zambian Airways was maintained by the South African Airways, how Zambian Railways was maintained by South African Railways. In fact, the locomotives came from South Africa. How Zambian veterinarians cared for Zambian cattle. How many Zambians were migrant workers in South Africa, and how many hundreds of millions of pounds a year that injected into the economy of Zambia. And Kenneth Kaunda then declared that because of South Africa's human rights abuses, Britain should impose sanctions. It was at this point that Margaret Thatcher produced our information. Who are you to speak about human rights abuses? You are an unelected dictator of a one-party state. Four British missionaries are being held without trial as presidential detainees in Lusaka's central prison, tortured and abused by your own security forces. Now, Kenneth Kaunda was dumbstruck. He was humiliated. He was the chairman of the frontline states. He was the spokesman of the sanctions crowd. And here he was. He was the leader of the pack, of the anti-Margaret Thatcher pack at Vancouver, and he was demolished. The Iron Lady wiped the floor with him. When he got back to Lusaka, the first thing he said as he came off the aircraft was, "Get those missionaries out of here!" And a man in a pinstripe suit came racing over from the president's office, and as I was called out, I put out my hands, expecting to be handcuffed, and he shook my hand and said, "His Excellency the President has ordered your release." And I said, "Well, what about the rest of you?" "No, no, your whole team." And we were whisked out, and on the way out of town, he stopped to buy us an ice cream. I couldn't help but notice, as we passed by the Freedom Monument in Lusaka, to notice that the Freedom Monument's behind bars. There's something significant about that. Well, when we got reunited to our vehicle at Livingston and then driven to Cousin Gouda Ferry and put across, the last words I said were, "See you again, Mr. Hammond." And then, as I said to Rob Brown, our Aussie, "See you again, Mr. Brown." Rob responded, "The only way I want to see Zambia again is from 10,000 feet through a bomb site."
Yeah.
You know, the Rekkies don't talk quite the same as the rest of us. In Lusaka Central Prison, I met the next governments of Zambia. For example, General Godfrey Muyanda became Vice President, Minister of Education as well, under Frederick Chiluba. Here's Frederick Chiluba's good friend. In fact, he's one of the key spiritual advisors to Frederick Chiluba, who advised him to declare Zambia a Christian state. Because Zambia, in 1991, succeeded in throwing off the secular humanist dictatorship of Kenneth Kaunda and his UNIP party. Then the first free elections ever, 5 votes for the MMD for every 1 for UNIP. It was overwhelming. They wiped the board, and Kaunda was history. And Zambia officially declared itself a Christian country. 31 October, Reformation Day, 1991. And they banned abortion. They banned pornography. They banned homosexuality. They put the Bible and prayer back in schools. And I went to our good friend Godfrey Muyanda when he was Minister of Education, and I brought him a whole lot of books. Many of these books right here. I gave him this big pile. And he groaned. And he said, "I love books. I love reading. But the demands of office leave little time for reading. Don't you have a small book that summarizes all of these?" And so that was my challenge, to write Biblical Principles for Africa. It was Godfrey Muyanda's challenge. And this Biblical Principle for Africa has been one of our best-selling books of all time. We're almost always out of print. We've brought out several editions, including in Afrikaans and in French. And at the moment, it's being translated into Russian. Of course, that'll be Biblical Principles for Europe. And it's been distributed in the Congo. Bishop Lumbalumba, Lubumbashi. I was invited to go to teacher training colleges around Zambia to run biblical worldview seminars for teachers and training by General Godfrey Muyanda. In fact, from being a prohibited immigrant under Kenneth Kaunda, we became VIPs, where I would not have to go through the normal lines. We'd get whisked at Lusaka Airport and so on through the VIP section with the diplomats, because we were now the friends, because I'd made friends with the next government in prison. You know, in Africa, yesterday's prisoners can be tomorrow's presidents.
Yes.
Yeah, it can happen. So you must treat your prisoners well. You just don't know what's going to happen next. Well, I've had the opportunity of getting to preach back in Lusaka Central Prison and to preach, in fact, even in Livingston Police Station and over in Lusaka Central Police Station, with the commissioner and others. They received me as an honored guest when they know that when I arrived there the first time, they were dragging me down the hallway with my legs and arms in chains and beating me. So, you know, what a change that the Lord can make. My father-in-law, Reverend Bill Bethman, has come there and ministered also. And we've managed to minister in Bible colleges, teacher-trained colleges, conferences and seminars throughout Zambia, and churches that are still being built. My son, Calvin, I took up there when he was still 7 years old, because I thought the Zambian people needed to see a young boy who could memorize scripture and present the gospel. And so Calvin, at age 7, was going to the schools and ministering at pastors' conferences, because I found many of the men don't think they should teach their children. They think the woman should do that. But I wanted to show them, your children can learn a lot early, and the father should be teaching the children. And so Calvin made such an impact in this one church that, in fact, the TV station came out and filmed him. And all around the rest of Zambia, people, you the boy we saw on TV giving the gospel presentation. And so another of our good friends, General Ronnie Shikapasha, Minister of Foreign Affairs, and then also Minister of Home Affairs, and he would receive us regularly and was a good friend. He used to be head of the Air Force in Zambia. And he was crippled in a car accident, and he was told he'd never walk again. His wife came to Christ. He came to Christ. He was healed. And not only is he walking, but he became Minister of Home Affairs, Foreign Affairs, and Minister of Information in successive administrations. He organized for us to meet with President Levi Mwanawasa at State House. Levi Mwanawasa at this stage was not a Christian. He came from a Jehovah's Witness background, but was excommunicated for getting involved in politics. We were able to spend an hour with him, share the gospel with him, and he was baptized in the local Baptist church, Lusaka Baptist Church, a few months after this. Levi Mwanawasa was very enthusiastic for the gospel. In fact, he was the one head of SADC who stood firm against Mugabe in Zimbabwe and who welcomed Zimbabwe farmers into Zambia, and he did a lot of good for the country. Under him, Zambia doubled the value of its currency and started exporting food for the first time since independence. And when I thanked him and congratulated him for that, he said, "You must thank Mugabe for that." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "The farmers Mugabe didn't want, I welcomed them to Zambia, and they have turned our economy around. Now we're exporting food for the first time." He said, "I went to the border and welcomed them, said, this is your home. Whatever you need from the banks, we'll give you the loans. Whatever equipment you need, you've got land, you've got equipment." And he said, "They are the ones who have managed to make Zambia a food exporting country." And he said, "We thank Mugabe for throwing out these farmers, which we've been able to welcome." Well, that's some of our work in Zambia. Colonel Jan Breitenbach of 3-2 Battalion, the Reconnaissance Commando, 44 Parachute Battalion, the most incredible legend in South African military history, he joined Frontline Fellowship back in 1988, and we traveled around in 1989 ministering all around Southwest Africa and Angola. We preached together from one side to the other, and Colonel Breitenbach was absolutely extraordinary going around the base, because he knew all the sins, and he would mention the sins. He named names. I saw the people squirming. We were in the Bastion. That's the military headquarters for Southwest Territorial Force in Vintel. And he was naming names and sins, and I saw the brigadiers and everyone just wilting and cringing, because he would be naming the sins. What an evangelist to have this special forces operator who'd now been converted to Christ naming the names and naming the sins. We went around, here's Colonel Breitenbach preaching to a group of 101 Battalion out on the field. We camped out at night, rolled out of sleeping bags at night just like this, and these are the ration packs that you get, and literally that was home for a month next to Colonel Breitenbach, hearing his stories. And so Colonel Breitenbach, one morning we woke up and he said, "Peter, let's go and preach the gospel to the communists." And so we got up and we managed to hitchhike a ride on a couple of helicopters, because Colonel Breitenbach's name could do wonders over there. And he'd say, "You know, give us a lift, we want to go and preach to the communists." And so after preaching to all the South African troops in Southwest Africa, Colonel Breitenbach and I went straight into Angola in order to preach to the communists. Now this is during the ceasefire. We got in these pumas and with feet dangling over the edge, off to the border, and we're going into Angola because at that stage there was this UN 435 Joint Monitoring Commissioner called JMC, and we were able to walk into Angola. You can see some people didn't use visas to enter in the past. This is about the only picture that we've got of that day's operations, but we went to three different places along the border. Choppers took us to different places, and we walked into Angola, and Colonel Breitenbach preached the most unusual evangelistic messages I've ever heard. He stood up and said, "My name is Colonel Jan Breitenbach of 3-2 Battalion. My men and I, we have killed thousands of you communists. Thousands. We never had any trouble killing you. Our problem was catching you. You ran so fast. You broke Olympic records running away from the fight. You could outdistance Biffles. You ran so fast." Said, "Why were you not willing to stay and fight, even when you outnumbered us 10-1? Because you're afraid of death, and you should be. You're not real soldiers. You're only brave when you've got some disarmed civilian with their hands tied behind their back with wire. Then you're brave, you can bayonet them in the back. But when you face soldiers, real soldiers, 3-2 battalion soldiers, you run like the spineless, yellow-bellied cowards you are." Now, all the way through, he's got a 3-2 battalion soldier translating this into Portuguese, making sure the commies are hearing this in their language. Yeah. And he said, "You know that when you die, you don't go to be with Jesus Christ in heaven. No, you're atheist. Your God is Karl Marx. Your religion is atheism. Your commissars are the priests of Satan. You're lost, you're damned. You're all going to burn in hell forever. If you knew what was going to wait for you 1 second on the other side of the grave, you'd crawl across the minefield and beg 3-2 Battalion to show you the way of salvation in Jesus Christ." I'd never heard anything like it. In fact, my hand went to my 9mm Browning on my hip, and I thought the colonel wants a short way to glory. I did not think that I would see the sun set that day. But we didn't just do it once, we did three times. And every time, surrounded by hundreds of communists, I saw them fingering the AKs, the RPGs, the RPDs, the PKMs, but they didn't do a thing. They must have thought we had something up our sleeve, and we didn't. In fact, the colonel had even forgotten his rifle back at the base. I was the only one armed of us there, and I had a couple of spare mags, and I thought, that's not going to last very long. But the commies are such spineless, gutless characters, nothing happened. Well, at the end of that day, we got back, the sun was setting, and we arrived back at Ruhr Corner Base, and we felt really good about ourselves. We thought, this has been a great day. This has been wonderful. As we walked in, the commandant came out and said, "Oh, Colonel, the lines have been humming today." He said, "The commies have been complaining to Pretoria, Pretoria's been complaining to the Bastion, the Bastion's been complaining to Ondangwa, Ondangwa's complaining to me, and the orders are, you and Hammond are to be evicted from the country tomorrow morning forthwith." Now, Colonel Breitenbach fired the first shots of the war back in 1966, as they attacked the SWAPO terrorist camp in Novemberland. He had fought 56 battles in his life, the most combat-decorated hero in South African history. He has been kicked out of Southwest Africa, the country he had devoted his life to fighting for, because he preached the gospel and hurt the feelings of a bunch of commies. Oh, shame. Their feelings were hurt.
No.
Oh. Well, that was one of the fun days in our mission. Mozambique was my first mission field, and going across the border into Mozambique was absolutely extraordinary. Back in 1989, I was arrested with a group of six American paramedics, medical missionaries, and one South African, so there were eight of us. We'd flown in to Malawi, and from Malawi we were working to Zambezi and Tet province. So each day we'd go into Mozambique, do ministry, and they do medical work. We'd come back to Malawi each night, and that was the operation. None of the Americans had been in Africa before. They asked me to introduce them, and I gave them a very good introduction, because we managed to get captured and arrested. Unfortunately, the pictures of that mission were all destroyed. In fact, I destroyed them when we were arrested. Because as we were being taken across Tet Bridge across Zambezi, I saw that I had our cameras next to us. And so even though I was handcuffed, I was opening up spools and exposing them to the lights and tossing them out the window. We had an open type a Jeep into the river, because I knew they mustn't ever open these and see all the pictures of us with Renamo gorillas. And I mean, they were at war. We'd just been with the enemies. But what happened was, we'd had a good day of ministry after a few days in Mozambique, in and out. And at the end of the day, we were on our way out, and I had been driving, and I, to give the Americans a chance to drive, I got into the back of the Land Rover, and they were driving. And they took a wrong turn, and I was saying, turn left, and they turned right, and we started to head down towards a checkpoint, and I said, you must turn around, but the roads in Mozambique are very narrow, as you've seen, very narrow roads. The Portuguese made these narrow, narrow roads. And I said, you've got to turn around. It would have been about a 15-point turn, but you had to turn around and get it. Because we were heading straight to Falima checkpoint. Mm-hmm. And this chap kept going, and I said, stop, turn around. And he just wouldn't understand the implication of it. And we got to this checkpoint, and suddenly we're swarmed around by communist troops. And, you know, AKs stuck through the windows, you will die! It's about the only English they seem to know. And they were screaming and screaming, and then they wanted passports. And when they saw the South African passport of one of our people, it was Peter Botha, racismo, apartheid. And when they asked what the work they did, one of the women said paramedic, and they went berserk. They had everyone on the ground, guns on the back, necks screaming, you will die. I presume they thought paramedic was something military. And it was actually very ugly. And the situation carried on like this. And we're talking about, you know, it would ebb and flow. There'd be this crescendos of hostility, and then there would be suddenly somebody would talk a bit more reasonably, and you'd think that the worst was over, and then someone else would turn up and it would get worse. Well, we spent the night in the vehicle, surrounded by these people screaming abuse. The next morning, we saw some of the Malawian police come along, and the Malawian police came and said, you must release them. Now, we were at the border. I think we were actually on the Malawian side, because there was a checkpoint, sort of as far as the back wall there, and we were this side. We were on the Malawi side. That was the Mozambique checkpoint. And the Malawian police came right up there and says, you must release them. They're on Malawi soil. Falima just laughed. Malawi police didn't carry weapons. Falima were armed to the teeth, Kalashnikovs and so on. And next thing, along came an armored car, and we were on the back of this half truck heading off to Villa Cortino, and there we were interrogated, and in came these Russian helicopters, MI-8s, and we were whisked off by these Russian helicopters through to Tech. We were taken through more interrogation. These MI-8 HIP helicopters arrived, and we were then prisoners of the Russians, and they took us to SNASP security police in Tet, and later in a Russian Antonov 26 flown through to Maputo. And there we were imprisoned. And it was disgusting conditions. It was different from the Zambian experience, because this was solitary confinement, each of us in a solitary confined cell. The cell that I was in was so small that if I lay on the ground, I could reach the one wall with my feet while my head touched the other side. I could reach out my hands and touch both sides of the wall. So that's how small it was. It was like a little box. The window, you could reach up and pull yourself up and look out the window. Interesting enough, one of the first people who walked past outside the window while I was in there was a South African recce who'd been in there for 5 years. And I asked a story, and he gave a story, and he said, there are three of us here, three South African reconnaissance commander who'd been locked up there 5 years. Now, I'm well connected. I get all the information. I'd preached in every South African army base that there ever was throughout the 80s, so I knew them all. And I never knew about us having three men in Mozambique in Mashava security prison for 5 years. Never heard of it. It wasn't in our papers. They gave me their details. When I got out, I went to Foreign Affairs and I said, why have you not gone to visit these people once in 5 years? Oh, they said, we don't want to endanger their lives. I said, endanger their lives? They're in SNASP hands in Mashava security prison. It doesn't get any more dangerous. You could at least bring them soap, salt, toothpaste, toothbrushes, pens, paper, food, vitamins, something, anything, something to read. Do you know what it's like to be locked up there for 1 day? Oh, no, it's very difficult, you know. Well, I published their story. I had their numbers memorized and everything else. Within a week, they were released. South African Foreign Affairs did nothing to release our soldiers for 5 years. But in just a week, a little mission like ours could get them out with a little bit of publicity. Publicity provides protection for the suffering. Well, I'm getting ahead of my story. So the first time I'm lying there, first morning, I wake up in a stinking little cubicle of a cell, and there was a bit of a gap under the prison door. And I woke up to a foul stench, and I looked there, and I could see this rat right there by my nose. I could feel his whiskers on my face, and I could smell the stench of this character. He must have crawled through the sewers. And, you know, imagine waking up to this rat, then he's about to take some nibbles, I guess. That didn't make me want to sleep after that. There were interrogations. To show you the importance of knowing your history, some people may wonder why you need to learn history at school. Well, I got hauled along for one interrogations there, down the cell, and I walked into a room. There were armchairs with leather straps for the legs and for the arms, next to a table that looked like it was a hardware store. All kinds of horrible tools with electric clips with wires attached to batteries. It didn't look good. And I walked in there, and of course, ignorance is bliss, and when you are in touch with all the persecuted church ministries, Voice of the Martyrs, Open Doors, Friends of Brother Andrew, we've got all of the materials. I read the Amnesty National Country Report, so I knew everything about Mashava Security Prison before I'd even got there. So, you know, your imagination does everything. I walked in, and I saw this, and I could just tell I'm in for a horrible, horrible time here. And the man came up to me and says, "I am the devil." I said, "You're not the devil." He said, "Oh, I'm the devil. I'm not only a Marxist, I'm a Leninist, and I'm a Stalinist. I was trained in Czechoslovakia." So I said, "I'm a Christian." And he said, "I hate Christians. In fact, I can't do justice." I mean, he spat it out. I literally spat it out. A real conversation stopper. And he just poured out his hate for Christianity, of Jesus Christ, and how evil Christians are. And then he started telling me how all true Christians should be liberation theologians because Jesus was the first communist. So I said, you know, that's logically inconsistent, because either Jesus Christ was the first communist, in which case you should support it, or he isn't, in which case, how do you say he's the first communist? So you can't have it both ways. And so he then launched into an attack on capitalism and on Margaret Thatcher's economic policies. So I launched into a defense of Margaret Thatcher's economic policies and an expose of the Labour Party's failure in Britain's economic situation. So he then went into a great teaching on the importance of the communist revolution. So I gave him a lecture on the French Revolution and on the Reformation. So he gave me a dissertation on the evils of America, and this carried on for 6 hours. I was watching the clock go, and I thought, I can do this all day. I mean, this beats having your fingernails pulled out any day. And we were literally swapping history lectures. And I could see, this guy obviously liked having someone to argue history with. So, you know, I can swap history lectures all day, that's fine. And at the end of 6 hours, he declared the interrogation over and sent me back to my cell. He hadn't even got my name. Now, let anyone tell me history can't save your life. Reading history books can really do a lot of good. I'm so glad I've got my fingernails and everything else still. Well, that was just one of several interrogations. And what's interesting about this is 6 months after I'd gotten married. So Nora was the only person back here in our mission office, which was in the back of a little barn. Literally, we had a barn as our first office with the water coming down inside the walls. And Lenora was there. We'd just gotten a new fax machine, new technology. So that fax machine helped save our life, mobilizing people around the world. And so she is trying to get the people around the world mobilized in demonstrations outside this Mozambican embassies. Now, one of the things that was important at the beginning of this was I knew the Mozambique government wanted me and wanted me dead. You can see some of these, which is Baptist Ministers Filimo's top captive. And it mentions, you know, Renamo's most important backer, and spoke all sorts of nonsense. Newspapers were going berserk. Now, from the beginning, I said to one of the Americans, he's an older man, can you be the leader of the group? I need to disappear in the background. Because Ministry of Justice threatened my life if I ever come back to Mozambique, so this isn't good. My Mozambique report's been read into the congressional record by Jesse Helms of the Senate in America, and they cut off aid to Mozambique. It was translated in Norwegian. The Norwegian government cut the aid to Mozambique over the atrocities. It was read in the parliamentary record in Britain. So Mozambique's government does not like me. So I just acted like I was one of the team, and the spokesman was this older man, one of the American paramedics, a doctor. And so they just assumed, and I just stayed in the background. Now, as it so happens, my passport, my British passport, said Peter Christopher, which is my second name, which took up the whole top line, and then Hammond's on the second line. And the whole way through, they were calling me Peter Christopher, Mr. Christopher, where's Mr. Christopher, Mr. Christopher, come forward, Peter Christopher. I didn't correct them. They missed the surname. And so nowhere was I identified as Hammond. And I just kept quiet. Now, at the same time, the people outside were really disturbed because newspapers in South Africa and America were screaming about this Major Renamo Becker, who was in the hands of Falima. But, of course, Mozambique speaks Portuguese. So translations would sit on someone's desk and take a while before it gets to someone else's desk. And there was obviously a time delay. The Mozambicans never fully comprehended who I was. I was the one who'd written all these exposés and the atrocities. And so the time came when we were released. In fact, there was a lot of false, you know, we're going to release you and then they're not, and so on and so forth. Well, at the end, we were marched into a room. And this room filled with people with AK-47s and camouflage weapons, but there was this very immaculate American woman, long blonde hair in a suit, and she said, "Who are the Americans?" Six hands went up, and lots of hugs and shrieks of excitement. "Let's get to the American Embassy for a shower and hamburgers," something like that. Off they went down the hallway with the arms around one another, chuckling, giggling, and shrieking. And there's this man in a pinstripe suit, and he said, "And who's the British gentleman?" Now, I was the only person there not dressed in camouflage, but I raised my hand, and he shook my hand and said, "Had a spot of bother? Let's get you to the British Embassy for a cup of tea." And that's the difference between the Americans and the British. Yeah. As I got to the British Embassy, which was in the corner of Mao Tse-tung and Vladimir Lenin or something like that, and he said, "Well, of course it wasn't called that when we built the embassy here." He showed me a plaque. He said, "I want to show you something." We walked around the side of the building. There's a plaque saying that in 1900, Sir Winston Churchill sought refuge in this embassy after escaping from a prison camp in Pretoria. Interesting. And he says, "Who knows, one day we may have a plaque here for you." I laughed and he said, "Oh yes, Mr. Hammond, we know exactly who you are." So we got to get you out of here fast. So the next morning, I was on the first plane out. I mean, they chartered a little single-engine plane, two-seater plane, and got me on that, and I was out before Falima could work out who they had, because he said, "If they work out who you are, you'll never get out of here." And so that was my experience in the killing fields of Mozambique, and that's in one of our books. So, any questions, comments?
How long did it take?
6 excruciating days in Mozambique. It doesn't sound very long, but at the time when you think it could be 6 years or 60 years, I mean, you know, I didn't know how long it would be, but it was high drama.
What year was that?
1989. Also October,
and
89.
Zambia
was October 87. It would seem that October is a good time to get arrested. Why, is that your birthday?
Yes.
Well, I'm glad it's good for some people. But at any rate, that was an extraordinary adventure. But how we got out of there, I just had to praise God. He opened prison doors and set captives free. Yes, Evangel, you got a question?
No.
A comment? A complaint?
Che Guevara died on my birthday.
I'm sorry?
Che Guevara died on my birthday.
Oh, excellent. Well, you know, on my birthday is the 21st of January. We're going to hike Table Mountain. And my birthday is the day that Vladimir Lenin died. I think that's a good reason to celebrate. It's also Stonewall Jackson's birthday too, by the way. Well, I'm sure you'd celebrate.
Wahoo.
Any other questions, comments, complaints?
What is the
present political situation in Africa, if one would, I mean, yeah, I know, I know it's complex, but I mean, in the light that you can be captured, I mean, what are the possibilities? What will give them reason at this point to capture?
I would say the most likely place you've got to be arrested right now in Africa is Zimbabwe.
Okay.
Now Frank's just been there. And Zimbabwe is definitely, I would think, the number one place where you're likely to get arrested right now, because the police and the army are paranoid, and they are hyper, and they are just looking for an excuse to lock you up for no reason at all. So Zimbabwe is probably about the worst place you could be in Africa right now, I'm guessing, in terms of arrests.
There's a lot of police presence, but not so much army.
Did you go to Madabeleland or Manicaland? Oh, you also went to Harare.
Yeah.
So you were in Mashonaland too?
Yeah.
Huh.
But at the same time, I'm fine if you keep to a story and they ask you a couple of times the same story, don't worry about you anymore.
You do need to be careful. By the way, there's a few other things I could have mentioned, such as when I was arrested, I realized I had my SADF military identity card on me, which I should never have crossed the border with. We were at war with them at that stage. So I had my military ID card, which even was it gave access to high security clearance and military intelligence, which I ate that card. Now, it's a plastic card. There was nowhere I could flush it or get rid of it. There was no plumbing. All I could do was eat it, which was disgusting. But I had to do that. I had a British passport, and the last thing I needed was a South African military identity card. So I just had to digest that blasted thing. The photographs we had to get rid of. But there was, these sort of things were things we had to do to prevent ourselves getting in the worst possible.